You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Happy New Year, Lionel Burney.
Happy New Year, Richard Moore.
And Happy New Year, Daniele Fribarancini.
Hello, chaps. How are you? You're looking very svelte after the Christmas period. It might just be the slightly dodgy FaceTime connection that we've got, but
yeah, well, you're slimming. You're in your new Berlin studio there.
Well, I'm actually in Acapulco.
Oh,
what?
So I'm in a meeting room called Acapulco.
All right, okay.
I'm in some hip co-working place in Berlin, and you know, I'm here sort of swirling I'm not actually swirling my cappuccino around my artisanal mug, because obviously it's too late for that. It's past midday.
But you, you're in your element there, surely, amongst the hipsters of Berlin in a shared working space. Daniel, it's where I always saw you ending up.
Yep.
Whereas Lionel and I, we're in London here, beside a building site.
We are near St Pancras Station. Usual home venue for us, this, isn't it, Richard? Kicking off the year as, not as we ended last year, of course, because we ended last year's regular podcast with a game of Scrabble in a pub with Ned Bolting. If you haven't listened to that, do go back. You're in for a treat.
Well, we thought about just doing that every week for the podcast, didn't we? A different board game every week, but we're not going to do that.
Well, I thought maybe next year, or rather this year now, we'll play Monopoly, and whoever is Team Ineos gets all of the money, all the stations.
Maybe it'll be Jumbo-Visma by the end of the year, Lionel. Maybe Jumbo-Visma will be the new Team Ineos.
A game of cycling-themed Monopoly. How would that go?
Well, I mean,
who signed the old boot for 2020?
if you're in Ineos, would you be parking an enormous camping car rather than a hotel on Park Lane?
Absolutely. Oh, this could run and run. I want to say something about going directly to. No, I don't want to say that, do I? I don't want to say that.
No. So, chaps, well, this is our first podcast of 2020, and as tradition dictates, I think we're going to look ahead to the season. But we kind of had a couple of slightly different podcasts towards the end of last year, didn't we? We heard from Flavio Zappi, your interview, Lionel, and we heard again from the youngish Americans. So we didn't have a news roundup for a while. Do you have some bullet points, some headlines for us?
Well, just the most recent bullet points. Not going to recap everything that's happened over the winter. I think as the season unfolds, we will cover a lot of the stories as they come at us. But just a few things that have happened over the first part of this week. The Tour de France has finalised the team lineup for the 2020 Tour. It will, of course, be the 19 World Tour teams plus the French team Total Direct Energy, who qualify via the UCI rankings, and the two wild cards are Arkea Samsic. No real surprise there, because they have Nairo Quintana, of course, and the Dandelion Picker, Daniel. It's going to be interesting to see how they gel as teammates as the season goes on. And the other
wild card. He's going to give us his actual name. I like that. It's just a Dandelion Picker now.
Well, I was hoping he'd chip in.
Warren Barguil. Just to give him his name.
Old Stoneface Nairo Quintana and the Dandelion Picker.
Already a winner, Quintana, this year.
Yeah, true, in a sort of club race, though, wasn't it? No? Wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think so, yeah.
I mean, it looked fantastic, that race. There were clips that went round online of, it was sort of pub cycling, the way it was described, a sort of impromptu, informal mountaintop finish on a cobbled climb about 17,000 metres above sea level in Colombia. But it looked it looked quite impressive.
Yeah, we spend the winter playing Scrabble in pubs, and Quintana just goes out and rides a 17,000 meter climb.
Absolutely.
But he looked pretty good in his new Arkea Samsic kit.
The other wildcard team is BB Hotels Vitel Concept, which means there's no place for Wanty Group Gobert. They've paid the price really for losing Guillaume Martin, I would suggest.
The one great benefit I see in this announcement, chaps, is that if I'm not mistaken, I didn't meant to check this before the pod today, but when BNB announced their sponsorship by that company, They did make mention of the fact that they would try wherever possible to be staying in that particular chain of hotels. And hopefully that means that all the B&B hotels will be booked up for France and we won't have to stay in them, because I don't know if you chaps have spent much time in B&B hotels over the last few years, but I'm not a huge fan, I have to say.
It can't be as bad as Formula One. Surely.
No, they're better than Formula One and better than Premier Class as well, but slightly inferior to Ibis, I would say.
Ibis Budget or Ibis? Because there's two, isn't there? There's two tier. There's Ibis à deux vitesses, isn't there? There's Ibis and Ibis Budget. Ibis Budget is kind of
There's another Ibis as well. We stayed in one in Toulouse last year. Very nice Ibis. I can't remember what the branding is, but it was a nice one.
Well, this isn't the hotels podcast, is it?
No.
Although we probably should do a GC of chain hotels at some point, or a GC of just hotels that we stay in. We really, every year we say this, let's keep a proper...
Well, it was an episode of Clumsy Zero, wasn't it? One of our listeners ranked all the hotels that the team stayed in last year.
That's right. But we should really, we should document where we stay. Remember to take photos of every hotel. Maybe put them in our next book.
We've been talking about that very thing, yeah.
Anyway, the racing is already underway, not just impromptu show up and race events in Colombia, but the Australian National Championships are underway. The time trials have already taken place. Sarah Gigante won the women's time trial. She, of course, won the road race last year, so she's added a time trial title this year. And the men's race was won by Luke Durbridge of Mitchelton Scott by 18 seconds from the world time trial champion, Rowan Dennis of Team Ineos. And Durbridge has said that Dennis's presence in the event really gave him the spur that he needed to win the title. Jumbo-Visma's Chris Harper was third there. What else is new for 2020? Well, there's loads new, and we'll talk about a bit of that in this episode, won't we? But the two things in the sort of the overall team makeup that everyone needs to get to grips with is that Cofidis are back in the top division. They're in the World Tour this year with Elia Viviani racing for them, having transferred across from De Koenig Quickstep. And the Israel Startup Nation is the new World Tour team, in the sense that it's taken over Katusha Alpecin's license, and quite a few of their riders. We'll probably talk about Israel Startup Nation a little bit later on in the podcast. And today, the route of Paris-Nice has been unveiled. It always keeps me on tenterhooks, this. You know, how will they get from Paris to Nice? Well, they're going from Plaisir, which is near Paris, and they're finishing in Nice, Richard. Would you believe it?
Wow.
More news like that over the next 360-odd days of the year. Bet you can't wait.
Well, we were going to look ahead, each of us, to sort of pick out three things that we were looking forward to in 2020, races, riders, teams, and I think we were going to start the year with that. Have you picked out three things, Lionel? Are you starting, or Daniel? Are you starting, Daniel? Are you getting us rolling in 2020?
Well, Richie, I'll start with Israel Startup Nation. In fact, snappy new name, or rather. Three teams, them being one of them, who I think in 2020 will be really looking to sort of build, create a new identity. The others being Bahrain, McLaren, and also NTT, formerly Dimension Data. Bahrain, McLaren, new management with Rod Ellingworth pulling the strings there. And NTT, we think there's going to be a press conference in Denmark today to announce that Bjarne Riis is the new team manager. Just very briefly on three teams, Katusha Alpecin, or the sort of carcass of Katusha Alpecin, was provided a lot of riders for Israel Startup Nation, but you know, we saw how that team kind of fell apart at the end of last year. Lots of different nationalities involved, and yeah, no real sort of clear soul to that team, Katusha Alpecin, at the end, and Israel will have to find that. Bahrain, McLaren, still questions there over how to sort of mesh this new British influence with the old Slovenian, Croatian body of sort of staff and the questions there. Also, that came up last year about the Operation Adalas doping investigation. And then NTT with Rees, a team that desperately needed a new direction, a sort of strong hand guiding them. They've opted for Rees. That's going to be controversial, but might also, well, I'm not going to say it's going to be, I'm not going to say it'll be a shot in the arm. But hopefully it will give them a bit of a boost.
I mean, there was rumoured that Shane Sutton was in the frame for that job. So if they had to go with Shane Sutton or Bjarne Rees, well,
it's close, isn't it? But Rees just gets it.
It's an interesting appointment, that's for sure. But we were at Bahrain McLaren's sort of official launch in December, weren't we, Lionel?
Yeah, we went down to Woking. Which is the headquarters, of course, of McLaren, the Formula One and supercar company. I was quite impressed with the slickness, I guess, of the presentation. We were in a room which was a bit like the Starship Enterprise, all seats around a nicely lit floor, and one by one the people came and talked to us. Wasn't a great deal of opportunity for to glean much information about what was going on. But one thing that I did pick up was that, I had a couple of conversations afterwards with people from McLaren, and I was just thinking, in a sort of geopolitical sense, I wonder how we will look back on this era of not just cycling, but all kind of professional sports, the direction that professional sports are going in. And this was a thought that was sparked by one of the people from McLaren, kind of glossing over the era of tobacco sponsorship in Formula One. And he kind of caveated an anecdote about how important Marlborough's sponsorship or the Philip Morris company sponsorship of the team had been in the 70s and 80s when they were frankly desperate for money. And I did kind of make the comment, I wonder how future generations will look back on a team sponsored by, a Middle Eastern state and a supercar company. And one of the things that I picked up just from the presentations, and I haven't sort of followed this up, but a sense that perhaps there is a sort of medium and longer term strategy at play here for a company like McLaren. They were talking a bit about how having the cyclists and working with athletes who obviously, go to extremes in endurance will feed back and give them information about human beings and health and how the human body responds to things. And I just picked up a small glimmer of perhaps something, because we're always trying to piece together, what's in it for a company like McLaren to get involved in cycling. It's not like they're even getting involved in developing bikes at the moment. That was something that they said they weren't interested in at the moment. And that was something that I just, from a distance, thought, well, maybe there's a fit there. Perhaps McLaren could develop their own bikes, as that they work in many of the same materials. But just quickly on Bahrain McLaren as well, I was surprised to see Milan Urzen, a former rider, of course. He was a sort of a bit of a sprinter, rode for a small Slovenian team at the end of the 90s, and has been a part of this investigation, the Operation Adalas investigation. And I, from sort of off the record or sort of background conversations, had been led to believe that Urzen had been pushed into very much the background. But he was there at the
He's co-managing launch. Director of the team with John Allert from McLaren.
That's right, Rich. I gather that the UCI weren't terribly happy that Urzen wasn't on the team's official staff list, didn't have an official role last year when the Operation Adalas story broke. That caused them some concerns to have someone clearly associated with the team, working with the team, but not officially part of the roster. And as I understand it, the UCI has requested that the team give Urzen a formal role as part of the World Tour license process. That was a requirement made of the team. I gather as we speak that that's something that's still pending, but the intention is from the UCI's point of view that they firm up Urzen's position within the team, so that there isn't a situation where people are working with the team but are kind of in the background. They want to know everybody who is associated with the team.
Well, you wonder if he's on borrowed time a little bit. Maybe the team feel they can't do anything while there's nothing concrete from the investigation. But also what the implications would be for the Bahrain sponsorship were anything to happen in terms of uncovering stuff about him. Who knows? Well, I guess we'll find out. Just on Israel Startup Nation as well, I mean, you mentioned the team, Daniel. They've obviously been developing over the last few years as Israel Cycling Academy, but they are, as you say, a very international team, but very reliant, it looks, from the roster on Dan Martin and Niels Pollitt for the classics, but also probably the Tour de France. I mean, Pollitt is an up-and-coming rider. Dan Martin, is he in decline? We know that Andre Greipel, who's joined that team as well, is beyond a fading force. I mean, he's not even... Is he still fading? Is there still flickers of life in Andre Greipel? But they are... It does look quite quite threadbare, the lineup for Israel Startup Nation.
I think the thing is, this is very much a marriage of convenience, isn't it, really? If you think back to when the Giro d'Italia started in Israel, Sylvain Adams was the driving force behind the Giro going to Israel. He is also one of the biggest figures behind the team. And he stated then that his ambition was to get into the World Tour one way or another. And I know, you know, when Team Sky were... when Sky was dropping out and Team Sky was looking for an alternative, I don't know whether there were any talks, but I know that, well, it was reported, wasn't it, that Adams was very keen to, see if there was any opportunity to get into the World Tour that way. That didn't happen, of course, and Katusha, the license, the UCI World Tour license becoming available, gave him the opportunity and gave the team the opportunity. And they've really had to do the best. It looks like a kind of a best case scenario. They've taken riders from Katusha who had contracts that went beyond the end of last year. They've taken some of the riders across from Israel. One man that's kept a spot in the Israel side of the bargain was Conor Dunn, of course, the former Irish champion. He's not there, but Dan Martin is an interesting signing, gives them some punch for the Ardennes races and stage racing in general, but it does look like a sort of a bit of a supermarket sweep of a team,
together team.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Rory Sutherland, 37, Alex, Andre Greipel, Alex Dowsett. There's some quality in there and some experience, but whether or not there's a raft of wins, I don't know.
No, I think they'll be fine when they're fielding their sort of A and even A and a half team. There are some riders who have been slowly sort of developing under the radar and getting good results the last few years, like Hermans and Chimolai had a very good season last year. But it's in the sort of lesser World Tour races and the sort of sub-World Tour races, particularly towards the back end of the season, where I think they might struggle, especially if the big names haven't delivered. And, it's a team that you could well imagine getting sort of halfway through the season with not many wins, because they don't appear to have a prolific sprinter in there. Certainly, Greipel is no longer a prolific sprinter on the evidence of the last couple of years. So that could be a bit of a problem. And just lastly, on NTT, I sort of flippantly said that Rhys could be the man to galvanise them. I think that probably will be the case, and especially when you look at the sort of stars that didn't perform last year. Michael Valgren was the big name signing that really had a disastrous last year. Not, I understand and believe, through lack of kind of effort or lack of, hard training, but more because he got things slightly wrong in his training. And Rhys, whatever else you think of him and say about him, he does have this quiet, sort of slightly menacing charisma and an ability to motivate people.
And a fellow Dane, of course.
And a fellow Dane. So I think they've got a good roster as well. I think they've got riders who can do well on a variety of different terrains, and I think they'll have a much improved season.
What else are you looking forward to, Daniel, 2020?
Well, Rich, I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to the Tour de France, or Nice-Paris, as they're also calling it. Of course, it's starting in Paris.
Very good.
finishes in Paris. I'm particularly looking forward to the first week of the Tour de France, the most Vueltified first Tour de France week in that we can remember. I mean, we have talked about this kind of Vueltification of the Tour de France, the search for sort of more gimmickry, things to spice the race up, make it a little bit more interesting, and maybe break the stranglehold of what was Sky. This year, that is particularly the case in the first week with the start in Nice. The first stage, I think, is going to be a sprint. But thereafter, you know, there's a mountain stage on stage two, a bona fide mountain stage. The race is going over 1,500 meters altitude twice. And another mountain stage, a mountaintop finisher, Ossier-en-Maillet, made famous in 1971 for Luis Ocaña taking Eddy Merckx to the cleaners. That's on day four. And then another mountaintop finish of sorts on day six at the Mont Aiguille. And that was made famous by Tim Krabbers, the rider. Mont Aiguille, not the hardest climb, but it's gonna certainly it will break things up in the general classification. And you know, it's a very unfamiliar looking first week of the Tour de France, and I think a lot of the teams will be very uncertain as to how it's going to play out. And besides that, it's going to be absolutely beautiful as well. Mont Aiguille is a stunning location in the Cévennes. The Devoluy Mountains on stage four, as I said, Ossier-en-Maillet, that's another really beautiful part of the Southern Alps. So I think that's going to be a real refreshing change for the first week of a Tour de France.
I'm kicking myself for missing the opportunity to coin Nice-Paris, but I'm going to say it so often that people would just think that it was my idea. Sorry about that, Daniel. Mont Aiguille. I went on a geography field trip there in sixth form at school, and I can remember the roads being extremely twisty because everyone got car sick in the bus. But it's also absolutely stunning and really quite remote.
Do you have extra responsibilities on that as a school captain on the?
Well, no.
I think I've been waiting 6 years to say that on the podcast. Well, 2020 started well.
It's quite remote territory for the Tour de France, that the Cévennes. It doesn't go into that terrain. Go to the Massif Central a little bit over quite frequently, but the Cévennes is it's narrow roads and really quite remote towns and villages.
I'm looking forward to kilometre zero recreating that geography field trip.
and chaps, linking to that, the third thing that I'm mainly looking forward to in 2020 is the prospect, the likelihood of Thibaut Pinot and Julien Alaphilippe encore in the Tour de France. That's to say, you know, that pair, the two French riders recreating sort of some of the excitement they provided in 2019. Will they, won't they? I mean, I've got my doubts. Pinot, I think, as I mentioned when the or as I felt when the tour route was unveiled, it will play both in his favour and against him, I think, in the sense that, you know, this first week where the stress levels might fall slightly when there's a first sort of shake up in the general classification on the second day. The race for the yellow jersey will certainly be sort of taken away from the sprinters. That might help matters, make it a bit less stressful. We know he doesn't like the sort of stress on the flat days. On the other hand, there are so many general classification days in this Tour de France, he's going to have to stay focused you always have to stay focused in the Tour de France, in his case on the flat days. But I just think that he's going to have to perform, and he's going to have to come to the fore on 15 or 16 of the 21 days. And you know, that has been his issue so far in his Tour de France career, in his Grand Tour career. When things are not going perfectly for him, they can also very quickly fall apart. And that's kind of what happened last year. It worries me a little bit that when he talks about the knee injury that he had in the Alps, he still says that it was a mystery. I remember the days when it happened last year or after it happened and talking to the France de Jeux staff and they were completely flummoxed and perplexed by it. And, you know, this is a rider who, has a sort of history of experiencing problems, you know, when the pressure is at its its most intense.
Yeah, and I think psychologically this is really difficult for him because in his last two Grand Tours, because he rode a Vuelta as well, but in the Giro in 2018 and the Tour in 2019, and the Giro, remember, he sort of manoeuvred himself into a podium position there, didn't he, with one day to go, really, and then fell apart. And then it repeated at the Tour, where it was in the last 48 hours of the race that suddenly he fell apart. Now, both legitimate medical reasons. The first, I think, he suffered a sudden illness, and quite a serious illness. And at the Tour de France last year, it was the injury. But that no matter how well the first 2.5 weeks goes for him, he's still got this historic problem, you know, that Simon Yates might have had as well had he repeated his Giro 2018 experience. And I think psychologically for him, winning the Vuelta that year was very important. But for Thibaut Pinot, putting it all together over 3 weeks is something. Well, he did it in 2014, of course, but he hasn't done it really since then. And that is a big hurdle to overcome, especially when nowadays the last couple of days of a Grand Tour are so important. The one thing in his favour is the finish to this year's Tour, the La Planche des Belles Filles time trial. You know, that's a more controllable event. It's a climb he knows very well. It's local to him. But still, there'll be this mental hurdle to overcome, I think, in the final few days of the Tour.
And Rich, you know, what I said about the route being a bit of a gift and a curse for him, you know, even that, the prospect of that final time trial to La Planche des Belles Filles on his doorstep where he grew up, that could be something to look forward to, or something which becomes a bit of a burden that he will feel that, you know, if he's not there and if he's not in contention on that day, he's almost, he's letting people down, which of course is not the case. But, it feels almost as though everything, all the stars are aligned for him and the route is made for him. And that creates its own sort of burden. As regards Alaphilippe, there's been a debate that sort of opened up about whether he should switch focus in his career. He sort of batted that back and said that no, he doesn't intend to become a sort of GC rider or certainly build his season around challenging the Tour de France. I also don't think he has to with this Tour de France route. The way it's set up, okay, there are summit finishes. He's not a pure climber, but they're not steep climbs in that first week of the Tour de France. I just think he needs to ride exactly the way he always rides, and he will probably end up in the yellow jersey in the first week of the Tour de France. And from there, we saw what happened with this huge wave of this momentum that came really from the French public, the French media last year. And he can surf that, and he will surf that. He's someone who feeds off that, whereas other sort of riders pale and kind of go into their shell amid that sort of adulation. That's not what happens to Alaphilippe. So, you know, he can carry the momentum of the first week into the second week and then hope to sort of hold on. I mean, with him last year, it's almost, he's the kind of guy who, if he ever does win a Grand Tour, it's sort of, it's like a balloon deflating, and he just has to stop the balloon or sort of slow down that process of the air coming out of the balloon and hope to sort of dribble over the line.
A tight knot is the key.
Yeah, and that's pretty, that's almost what he achieved last year. My doubt this time is that the last week is so... it's so hard that...
I was talking about balloons. I'm not sure how that actually translates into cyclists. But anyway, take from that what you will, Julian.
My doubt this year is that the last week is so hard that if he's already sort of running on fumes, then it will be difficult. And they're also probably going to be more contenders. Last year, I mean... perhaps unkind to Egan Bernal to feel that, you know, the absence of Froome made the Tour and the battle for the general classification feel a little bit sort of decaffeinated. And you know, riders will drop out, or there'll be illnesses and injuries that crop up between now and July. But looking at it now, in January, it seems as though there are going to be an awful lot of very strong contenders for the Tour this year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, that's a familiar voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, of course, interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it's sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom.
Indeed it is. The Watt Bike Atom sponsored the bulk of our Tour de France coverage last year, and they are back for 2020. And what a great time of year to talk about the Watt Bike Atom, because it's January, it's the peak season for indoor training, of course. And, well, if you're thinking of upgrading your indoor cycling equipment, why not look at the Watt Bike Atom? Because it's the one piece of kit for the job, isn't it? We both, Richard, took delivery of Watt Bike Atom to have a test ride.
That's why we were in such good shape at the Tour de France last year, Lionel, because we used the Watt Bike Atom in the run-up to the Tour just to arrive there in peak fitness, and then waste it all on lots of big meals and sitting in a car for 3 weeks. But I've really enjoyed it, as much as you can enjoy hurting yourself on a bike indoors. But the information that you get, the stability of the machine itself, made it as enjoyable as it could be, and also made the time pass a lot more quickly, especially the sort of the data that you were getting back from your rides.
Certainly for me, it felt like a big step up from connecting your own bike to a turbo trainer. The Watt Bike Atom is built for the purpose. It's very stable. It's got drop handlebars on it that, you know, make you feel as close to riding a bike outdoors as you can indoors, I think. And for somebody like me who, you know, I like to be able to turn things on and get straight into it, there was absolutely no faff connecting up with Zwift and with Trainer Road and with the other apps that are available. So you can basically just get it set up, plugged in, and away you go.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the data and the information that you get. The one that fascinated me was the pedal effectiveness score. I was using the Watt Bike app for that, and getting lots of information back about the differences in the balance between my right leg and my left leg, my effectiveness at all parts of the pedal stroke. And, you know, the whole point of training is to see progress, isn't it? And one thing I enjoyed about having the Watt Bike Atom for a while was being able to see my progression, being able to make little improvements, and then to see whether they'd been effectively sort of transmitted in my training. And that was the most enjoyable and rewarding part of it.
Well, the fastest track to improvement is following a structured plan, of course. And the Watt Bike Atom has a range of workouts and training plans. So if you're riding a big sportive in the summer, or you're, you know, getting ready for a multi-day cycling event, or you just want to get quicker on the bike and leave your buddies behind on the hills, then check out the Watt Bike Atom. And if you want to purchase one from £76 per month, visit wattbike.com. That's Wattbike, WATTBIKE.com.
The Cycling Podcast. For the latest news, views, and interviews from the world of professional cycling. Support our work and get exclusive episodes by becoming a friend of The Cycling Podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe.
Well, we must say a big thank you to all of you who have signed up as a friend of the podcast. We launched our new program of friend special episodes about a month ago, and there's been an overwhelming response to that, really, our best ever. So we're very grateful to all of you who have signed up. There are 4 episodes now available on our new system, and I think that's one reason why so many of you have signed up. It's very, very easy to use. Very easy to sign up and very easy to get the episodes straight onto your phone. So the 4 that are there are The Stage That Didn't Finish. That's a look at stage 19 of the Tour de France that was cut short, and also an interview with Egan Bernal. We've also got our Grand Tour Diaries, the first installment of those from the Giro d'Italia. That's basically the audio book of our physical book. We've got the best bits from our own Grand Tour, our shows in Belfast and Edinburgh feature in that episode. And we've also got an old episode there that you voted for on Twitter to appear in the new feed. That is our special from a few years back, looking at the HTC High Road team, the best team of this century, we said. That may be subject to discussion, but it's there as well now. There's lots more coming. Tour de France diaries are coming soon. It costs £15 to become a friend of the podcast. If you pay a bit more, if you pay £50, you can get a signed copy of our book. You'll get that sent to you. If you pay £100, you'll get a signed copy of the book, and you can also submit an idea for our, well, to the guest edit our friend's special later in the year. We've done that the last couple of years with great success. There's a little bit of a backlog with the books at the moment. It's been Christmas, and we have to get them all signed. So we're a wee bit behind. You should, if you signed up as a friend by Christmas, you should have your book by now. But if you signed up over Christmas and since then, it should be arriving the next week or so.
Yeah.
In the next week.
Just on the new system, I mean, it's got our creative ideas flowing, hasn't it? Because the system is so much easier for people to use. It's making us think about what we can do to deliver value for the support that you're giving us. So thank you very much for that. Just a couple of sort of technical points. If you're a previous friend of the podcast, this is a new system. So your old password and what have you is not compatible and is not needed. And also, if you do have any issues with getting connected first time, don't sort of labour away in silence. Drop us a line. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Our tech genius, Jonathan Rowe, will sort you out and ensure that you get to listen to the episodes that you've signed up to listen to.
And a big thanks for the support, because not only do you get the episodes, you do help us produce this weekly free show, the monthly shows that we do, Service Course, the Cycling Podcast Femina and Explore, and to cover the Grand Tours on the ground and with daily episodes. So if you enjoy the podcast and you want to support it, £15 goes a long way. And you can also get 20% off the book if you do sign up as a basic friend of the podcast. So lots of reasons to sign up as a friend of the podcast. If you just want to buy the book, you can also do that by going to thecyclingpodcast.com. Still copies available. So hope you're enjoying the book if you're reading it. And thanks very much, everybody who's bought a copy. Okay, well, I'll go, will I, with three things that I'm looking forward to in 2020. I mean, everybody, or a lot of people, are talking about Ineos v Jumbo Visma, the battle, especially at the Tour de France. But, I mean, Jumbo in particular, I did a friend special on that team last year, and it was clear that they were a team going places. They've added Tom Dumoulin this year, so they've already announced their team for the Tour de France. George Bennett is the only one that might be slightly miffed at missing out, but maybe he's got other targets.
What do you think about that, announcing the Tour de France team before Christmas? I mean, it's a great idea, but I mean, there's a lot of road to travel between now and the end of June, isn't there? Well,
I think it's a statement of intent as well, isn't it?
There's a cautionary tale as well from a couple of, was it 2 years ago with Mitchelton Scott and Caleb Ewan, where they put out a press release in the previous December, a lot of hullabaloo about the fact that he was going to ride his first Tour de France, and then it was a real bone of contention, didn't it, because they didn't pick him, and that then led to him not renewing his contract.
I think that for Jumbo Visma, it's a statement. It's this is how dialed we are, and how much we already know about what we're going to do next year. It's sort of taking the battle to Ineos. It's interesting how that team has developed. There was an interview yesterday, I think, with Nielsen Paulus, who's joined EF Education First, a very promising young American rider, and he felt that the regime at Jumbo-Visma was too much, especially the focus on diet. And it's interesting because I was at the training camp last year in Spain, in Catalonia, and they were on a special day where they were following a particular diet. They were not eating very much at all. You know, it was a no carbs day, but with a double training session. And it was clear that the focus is as much on that side of it as on the training, the physiological aspect. But they when you think about how the team has really transformed from what was a pretty weak team, Lotto NL Jumbo. They had a pretty pretty average kit, didn't they? That white and yellow, and that was a sort of symbol for how the team were performing. And it was really Stephen Kruijswijk at the 2016 Giro that he was the first sign that, you know, that there might be something to build on there. And since then, they've kind of they've been very impressive. Primoz Roglic, of course, is likely to be the leader at the Tour de France, but Tom Dumoulin will be there too, and Stephen Kruijswijk, who finished on the podium last year, of course. So I'm very interested to see how that plays out.
Rich, just I read that interview as well with Nielsen Paulus. I found it fascinating, and it did make me wonder to what extent, you know, as we talk more and more, and we have done over the past few years about teams becoming more and more regimented in what they do, and really sort of getting very granular on small details. You know, how much the sort of this theme of overthinking and trying to over sort of control the variables might become a bit of a theme both this year and over the next few years. I mean, there was another interview with Rowan Dennis where I think, you know, he would probably be quite open about the fact that that's not necessarily been his issue, but you know, him talking about the risk he felt he was running of developing an eating disorder, and you know, it's not necessarily a sort of one size fits all as far as pros and current pros are concerned, and you know, this hyper sort of scientific, hyper regimented, hyper granular approach is not for every rider.
Certainly, if Paulus is to be believed, he abandoned the plan that was set for him by Jumbo-Visma in the second half of last season, and actually, you know, performed really well at the Vuelta. So if that's what happened, then it seems that it wasn't a system that worked for him, and I think he's actually a very promising prospect who might do great things at EF Education First. But clearly it's working for some people at Jumbo-Visma. I think Stephen Kruijswijk, who I've mentioned, I think a lot of it flows from him. You know, I think that he's almost like a lab rat in a way, and my time with the team last year emphasised this point, that he had been a guy who, for whom this approach definitely works. He is incredibly dedicated, and I think they use him as a sort of role model for the rest of the team. He sets the tone, and I think the example of him and the progress he's been able to make, gradual progress each year, has been very influential in that team. But not everybody is Stephen Kruijswijk, and it might not work for them all. But, you know, they have got a very, very strong team, and they've got clearly a bit more money now as well. And if you look at the support that they can put around, you know, it's not just the trident of Dumoulin, Kruijswijk and Roglic, but it's guys like Sepp Kuss, Robert Hessink, Tony Martin. It's a very, very strong team, and man for man, it will be at least the equal of Team Ineos. But I think we'll talk a little bit more about Team Ineos later on. I'm also looking forward to seeing how the young generation get on this year, because it's a kind of second album syndrome. Remco Evenepoel, Egan Bernal, Tadej Pogacar, Pog, and Pavel Sivakov as well, I'd throw in there. Those guys all had incredible seasons and wins last year. You know, might it be more difficult for them this year? Will their progress be linear? I suspect not, because I don't imagine that Remco Evenepoel is going to get better every year. So far in his short career, that has been the case, but I don't think it's possible that he can get better every year. So I think one of those guys might take a slight step back or sideways this year. And it'll be very interesting to see, looking further ahead, how they respond to that, because that will be the test, of course, of, you know, how far they go in the long run.
Yeah, I certainly think Evenepoel has got the world at his feet, hasn't he? But the pressure really ramps up in the bigger races. You know, winning the San Sebastian Classic in the way he did was one of the most impressive performances of 2019 by anybody of any age. But when it comes to, you know, the biggest classics, the, you know, the World Championships, the Olympic road race, perhaps, you know, the pressure will be magnified. The same with Pogacar. You know, no longer is he the youngest rider in the race, the sensation. You know, after a couple of years or so, there'll be a new young rider coming along, and people will, you know, it's difficult to, as you say, Richard, it isn't just about making the announcing the arrival. It's about building a career and, putting year two, year three, year four on top of that impressive first year. So,
and the third intriguing thing for me this year really is Movistar, which is almost a new team in 2020. And there are probably various factors for that, not least the falling out with the pastry chef, the agent who is agent to so many South American riders. And it's not been confirmed yet, but Andre Amador, I think, is the latest rider to go from Movistar to Team Ineos. He's been spotted training in Ineos kit, although the transfer hasn't been confirmed yet. But Movistar for this year, I mean, they've got 14 new riders, which is the most, I think, of any team outside of Israel Startup Nation, which is, of course, new to the World Tour. But they've got 10 riders who are 25 or under, and five of those riders, 22 or under. So it's a really, there's a really new influx of very, very young riders indeed. They've also got 11 different nationalities represented in the team Movistar this year, which is a huge cultural change for them. You know, they were a few years ago very Spanish team, Spanish and South American. Pachi Vila has joined as head of performance from Bora Hansgrohe. He's been pretty successful there. Of course, he was at Tinkoff before that and has worked closely with Peter Sagan in the past. So it's a real reboot for Movistar. I was just calculating the average age. Of course, average age is still quite high because they've still got Alejandro Valverde. If you take him out, it drops by about 5 years. But they don't have an awful lot of riders. I mean, if you think of riders being in their peak between like 28 and 32, 10 of the riders are in that age category. But there aren't a lot of great, big stars in that age category. They've lost Mika Landa, they've lost Nairo Quintana. Quintana in particular has been, along with Valverde, central to the identity of that team. And so Enric Mas has come in. He's a young Spanish rider, promising but unproven. A lot is resting on his shoulders, Marc Soler as well. But you really get the sense that they are kind of transforming into a more international team and a much younger team, and looking 3 or 4 years down the road, it seems. I spoke to Gabriel Cullug the other day, who is a new rider on that team, a British rider, more of a sprinter, a classics rider. He is looking forward to the classics. He's going to have a lot of opportunities there. And I think in the next few weeks, we will do a special feature on Movistar in one of the episodes. We've got an interview you did with Eusebio Unzué, the man who's been in charge for 40 years at that team. I think we'll hear from his son and from Cullug as well.
Yeah, Unzué gave an interesting interview in the Spanish press a couple of weeks ago, Rich, in which he talked about sort of Landa in fairly wistful terms, suggesting that, yeah, he will probably one day win a Grand Tour. He's got what it takes, but unfortunately now it won't be with Movistar. And then also being sort of quite explicit about the fact that he thinks that Quintana's best days as a Grand Tour rider are over and he can't fight for general classification anymore. And then just the point you made on Acquadro, the Italian agent who's fallen out with Unzué. I mean, that creates a real problem because, as you've said, Acquadro has most of the top South American riders, and Telefonica, the sort of parent group of Movistar, have huge interests in South America. So not really a great look for them not to have one of these, this sort of galaxy of South American stars in their roster.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport. And if you want to stock up for the winter ahead of your Science in Sport goodies, go to scienceinsport.com and you can still use the 25% off discount. That's SISCP25 at the checkout, SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. And a big thanks to Science in Sport for extending yet again their sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast, which we really appreciate.
It's long running now, isn't it? It goes back to the Giro d'Italia in 2016. It's going to be the longest running sponsorship in pro cycling.
Probably.
I also Rich, this will vex you early in the new year. But I noticed one of the Arsenal players, Lucas Torreira, the Uruguayan midfielder, the other day getting an SIS gel with about 10 minutes to go in the game. I think it was against Man United. He was struggling a bit. They'd done a lot of running in that game. And yeah, so footballers now using gels in the middle of games.
Well, SIS do supply officially Manchester United. But they unofficially supply a lot of other clubs, including my team, Watford. I don't know whether that has extended this season, but certainly last season they were supplying Watford.
I think
so
Science and Sport might want you to keep quiet about that, Lionel.
Absolutely not. We've been on a tremendous run.
Watford must have
had some gels on about December the 20th because we won four league games in a row, or three league games and a draw. In four
right,
over Christmas.
I hadn't realised that.
Soaring away from the bottom of the table. Yeah.
Mikel Arteta in charge at Arsenal now. He's a Basque, isn't he?
He is.
He always reminds me of Mikel Landa. I don't know, I think physically they look quite similar.
They've got the same first name.
Dark hair.
goodness.
Olive skinned. But they do remind, they've got a sort of strong silent type about them.
Win, lose or draw, Arteta's expression doesn't change.
No, Landa's the same, isn't he?
My God, guys, can we not get back to the cycling?
Landa, I interviewed Landa at the Bahrain McLaren launch, and we might hear that interview at some point. He is uncontested leader at the Tour de France, and Rod Ellingworth really thinks he can win it. But I tried to sort of ask him about the whole Free Landa campaign and whether he enjoyed being a guy that people rooted for because he always, you know, had some sort of misfortune in terms of a teammate going slightly better than him. But he didn't really take the bait on that one. I don't think he really does enjoy that at all. I think he'd rather win. What a surprise. What three things are you looking forward to, Lionel?
Well, I'll do the quickfire round here.
You can't say napalm. It can't be starter, main course and dessert. we won't accept that.
Well, funny you should say that. We might come on to that in a minute. But first up, De Koenig Quickstep. Disappointing season by their standards last year. Just 68 wins after 73 wins the previous season. You have to, if you go back to 2012, De Koenig Quickstep Floors, whatever they've been called, they've won at least 50 races a year. 2011, they won only 9 races. So,
Nine.
Jonathan Vorter's
recently pointed out when in the discussion about relegation and promotion that in 2011. If a relegation system had been in place in the World Tour, they'd have dropped out.
Mm. Yeah, they had an absolute shocker and really a sort of a revolution from there. And, one of the things that we've often talked about with Patrick Lefevre, and it's something that came up in my conversation with him this time last year, which we put out for Friends of the Podcast last year, his kind of ruthless, single-minded focus when it comes to letting riders go when, frankly, they become too expensive for him. He cuts the emotion out of it. It seems to me, and lets people move on when he feels he can't pay them what they want or what they are perceived to be worth by others. And he's not frightened to let people go and freshen up and evolve the team. And so it is again. 2 years ago, lost Fernando Gaviria to UAE Team Emirates. This winter, Elia Viviani has moved to Cofidis after a so-so season, really, with them last year. Wasn't bad, but didn't get a win at the Giro, did he? Or rather, did get a win, but then it was taken away from him for an irregular sprint, and he never really got back on top after that. Certainly not in the Giro. And the long-awaited transfer of Sam Bennett from Bora Hansgrohe to De Koenig Quickstep was confirmed in very late November or December. And I'm looking forward to seeing how Bennett does, because I think he is more than just a sprinter. We gather that he will ride the Tour de France, and it will be the first time that he goes back to the Tour de France as a bona fide winner. But he's going to be in a position in that team where not only will he have plenty of opportunities to win, but there will be a real expectation on his shoulders to win.
My money would be on Sam Bennett having a much better season than Elia Viviani.
I would agree with you there. I'm not going to bet against that No, I think that the team setup there is so focused on winning that when the opportunities come round, everybody knows exactly what they're supposed to be doing in order to get somebody over the line first.
One guy in particular who I'm seeing on your screen there, Lionel, Michael Morkov, who's, you know, he was so instrumental in so many of Viviani's wins, and actually was missing at the Giro, which I think was important. And I think he could be absolutely key to Bennett, and he's such a good lead out man and pilot in that, you know, the closing couple of kilometres of races, that if he forms a good understanding with Bennett, they could be a quite formidable duo.
And yeah, ironically,
and he's also brought Archibald
yes,
with him, of course. So I guess Morco will play the same role that he did with Riquese and Gaviria, so he'll be the penultimate man.
They've got all hairstyles covered there, haven't they? Archibald, yeah, and Morkov.
Ironically, though, the Tour de France doesn't really offer the greatest number of opportunities for the sprinters, certainly not when compared to the Giro d'Italia. So the sprinting is going to be interesting this season. I mean, it's one of the things that we tend to kind of overlook a little bit, but when you think about the season as a whole, more races end in a sprint than not. When you factor in all of the Grand Tours, all of the one-day races, all of the week-long stage races, and so on, there are a lot more sprinting opportunities than anything else.
You got data on this, Lionel?
I have actually, but I haven't got it with me. But I will share some of this data.
Put that in the episode notes.
Yeah. But the Giro is going to have quite a strong sprinting field, isn't it? Peter Sagan will be there. Dylan Groenewegen. Going back to Jumbo-Visma, a casualty of their single-minded focus on the yellow jersey is that Groenewegen probably, almost certainly, won't be at the Tour de France.
Well, he won't be because they've announced the team already.
I know, but come on. I mean, if something serious happens in the first 6 months of the season, are you telling me that Jumbo-Visma aren't going to deviate at all from that strategy?
Rich, I was also struck by that, in the sense that I remember, I think it was in your Jumbo-Visma special last year, that Richard Plugger talked about this vision he had of being competitive on every day of the Tour de France. And, you know, if Wout van Aert is back to his best, which we obviously hope, but we haven't seen proof of that yet, he will be able to compete in the bunch sprints. They'll be missing Groenewegen, of course, and also Mike Tournesson, who won the sprint for the yellow jersey in the first stage. But they won't necessarily be quite as well equipped in the sprints as they were certainly last year, will they?
Well, secondly, Daniel, you joke that my three highlights of the year are starter, main course and dessert. Well, I am looking forward to going to Hungary for the start of the Giro d'Italia, not least because it will be an opportunity to have some authentic goulash. No?
Yes, Napalm. I'm also looking forward to the wine.
Lionel and Hungary are two words that you hear in the same sentence quite a lot.
I'm also looking forward to the second stage in particular. So I'm not particularly au fait with Hungarian geography, but I have looked a bit at the route of the first stage, and we go alongside a lake called Lake Batalon, I think it's called, and it's the largest inland lake in Central Europe. Inland lake. It's the largest lake in Central Europe. Most lakes these days tend to be inland. The northern shore of that particular lake is quite a well-known wine growing area. And some very strange, unusual, exotic grape varieties grown there. Not stuff you'll find anywhere else in Europe.
I've never been to Hungary, never been to Budapest, particularly looking forward to seeing, you know, the very grand squares and the Danube. And I do think that, you know, we've sometimes been a little bit critical of cycling's tendency to follow the money. You know, the Giro d'Italia has clearly been looking to monetize its product by going to other countries for the Grande Patente.
If it takes us somewhere we quite want to go, then we're all in favor.
Well, but it does broaden one's horizons, to go and see places with your own eyes. And I think that that's a, you know, Hungary is somewhere that's been on my list of places to go and visit, just to see. I do think that the UCI and whatever forces are motivating the UCI to have this strange rule about grand departs, grand departenzas, or whatever the Spanish equivalent is, Daniel.
Gran salida.
Exactly. When the race starts in a foreign country, the best thing for the race, for the riders, for the whole of the infrastructure, is to be able to start on the Friday and then travel on the Monday back to the host country. And because of this strange rule, which restricts the Grand Tours from doing that any more than once in every four Grand Tours, once in every four editions, the Giro has to start in Hungary on the Saturday, have two more stages on the Sunday and the Monday, and then get to Sicily over basically on Monday night, and resume with a stage on Tuesday afternoon. And I just think that it's a rule that exists for what reason? For what greater good? It will just put pressure on everybody, and not least the riders and staff who have to keep up with the schedule. So I think if thinking more broadly about things and thinking about what is best for the athletes and for the teams, it's probably a rule that the UCI needs to look at.
And Napalm, I don't actually know, just practically speaking, I don't actually know how the teams will transport everything from Hungary to Sicily. I'm talking about the vehicles in particular, the team buses and so forth. I guess they'll probably have to have two different buses and two different sort of fleets of vehicles, one lot that are waiting in Sicily and one lot in Hungary.
Yeah, I mean, Matt White said, I mean, they hadn't done the full logistics on it, but did say that it would be, a combination of, teams that have got two buses. One can go to Hungary, one can be waiting for them in Sicily, but then, rental vehicles and what have you, and two lots of staff, and just to cover the weekend at the start. It, logistically, it does place a tremendous strain on people, but I guess, May is a little bit lighter in the sense that there isn't the Tour of California this year, so that that eases the logistics a little bit. But sometimes cycling doesn't help itself in some of these things.
Just you've got Team Ineos up on your screen there, Lionel. We haven't really talked about them, but you finished your three things.
That's two of them. The
third
is Team Ineos. Somebody has to mention Team Ineos.
Chris Froome.
The thing I'm not looking forward to is the endless debate about who the leader is at the Tour de France. And I think that's going to be the inevitable kind of narrative that we all, to a degree, get
sucked
into.
Who do you think will be the leader at the Tour de France?
Well, I actually think that it suits Team Ineos to have two leaders. And I think that there's enough evidence now over the previous years to see that they excel at having two people well placed overall. They finished first and second a number of times in the Tour de France, going all the way back to Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome in 2012, Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome, Egan Bernal and Geraint Thomas last year, of course. And I think that it's
Mikel Landa, fourth one year, wasn't it?
Mikel Landa up there as well. I think this kind of story that there's some choice to be made, and that we all obsess about who's number one and who's number two, I think it works perfectly for Dave Brailsford, works perfectly for the riders, for everyone to be kind of distracted by that as the story, as the narrative going into the Tour de France. It spreads the load, it spreads the pressure, it means that they can kind of retrospectively decide on their tactics after the road has decided, and they can say, oh well, it was always our idea, that which to a degree they did during last year's Tour de France. It was always going to be Egan Bernal who was going to come to the fore in those last mountain stages in the Alps, and I think that they will do the same at the Giro by sending the defending champion Richard Carapaz and Geraint Thomas to the Giro, and then at the Tour de France, Egan Bernal, Chris Froome, and possibly Geraint Thomas if he comes out of the Giro so if they're going to go head to head with Jumbo Visma, why not go head to head numerically as well as anything else?
Some speculation about the state of Chris Froome's recovery and fitness. Dario Cioni was quoted as saying that he'd gone home early from a training camp. Chris Froome then sought to cold poured pour cold water on that.
And I understand, Rich, that Choney was quite aggrieved at how, in what context he'd been quoted.
Right.
It was an Italian monthly magazine that quoted him, and he felt that he was speaking in some sense off the record, or that it wasn't a formal interview.
No such thing as off the record, is there? I did try and contact Chris Froome just to find out, but he did say on social media that he, you know, that this was nonsense. But I think there are questions there, and that might influence whether, say, Geraint Thomas goes to Giro or not. Because I agree with you, Lionel, that would seem to make a lot of sense. There's been a lot of hints that Geraint Thomas would go to the Giro this year, and I think that would be the plan A, that Geraint Thomas and Carapaz at the Giro and Froome and Bernal at the Tour.
But we've seen just last year that they, unlike Jumbo-Visma setting out who's going to do what in December, last year Ineos changed their plans at very short notice, didn't they? Bernal was going to go to the Giro and then didn't
crash.
Crashed and then didn't go to the Giro. And then, of course, you know, professional cycling, you just never know what is going to come down the road. And I mean,
one thing for them to address is the performance of the rest of the team at the Tour last year. And they got away with it. But if they're going up against a very strong Jumbo-Visma team, they might not get away with it again. Pavel Sivakov, I understand, will ride the Tour, or is the plan is for him to ride the Tour de France this year, which I think he's a very strong rider to put into that team. One other thing I'm looking forward to is Lionel getting team names wrong in 2020. I love how, I mean, I pointed this out, but earlier on you said Wanty Group Gobert. It's actually, they're now actually Circus Wanty Gobert. Give them. You're allowed three sponsor names now in teams, so that's what they are this year. There's
I'm not looking forward to the mass deployment. There'll probably be conscription involved of the pronunciation police in Hungary because.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah,
Hungarian is a very difficult language. One of the most difficult languages, probably in the world, to learn.
Well, fortunately, Lionel and I have both been taking intensive lessons in Hungarian, and we're going there in fully intending and with the sole aim of shaming you in Hungary, Daniel. It's 3 days of just bliss, I think.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing how Orica Green Edge and Garmin get on this season.
Bit of a merry-go-round of sponsors. So Alpecin have jumped ship again. How many teams have Alpecin now? So they're now sponsoring Matthew van der Poel's team.
Third,
because they were a giant Alpecin, weren't they?
Oh, correct.
I mean, they've got a terrible track record, Alpecin, actually, of sponsoring teams and then the team not doing very well.
They have not sponsored as many teams, I don't think, Rich, as Vini Fantini / Farnese, which I think is the same company, who have now resurfaced on the jersey of Israel Startup Nation.
I'm waiting for Alpecin to sponsor a team run by Bjarne Riis with Levi Leipheimer as team leader.
Yeah.
Get all the baldies in the Alpecin team. Anyway.
Anyway,
So
much to look forward to. The year is unfolding before us. What have we got to look forward to on the podcast, Lionel?
Well, on the podcast front, I've been booking a few assignments. I'm off to Slovenia at the end of the month for something that may end up being a Friends of the Podcast episode, or it might be a regular episode.
Are you ski jumping with Rog?
Lionel goes ski jumping with Rog. The Friends special to end all Friends specials.
It certainly would certainly be my last contribution to the Friends specials, I think, if I went ski jumping. Booked a few interviews in, and I'm beavering away on the Reborn Explore series, which will launch at the end of this month or beginning of next. Haven't quite decided on the dates yet, but that is underway. And we've got a very big announcement, I think, next week. A new collaboration,
I think we've got a new contributor as well for Explorer. That'll be a big announcement as well. So,
indeed.
Well, listen, let's leave it there for their chats. We've barely scratched the surface of what we're looking forward to in 2020. It's going to be another huge year for the cycling podcast.
Yep.
Very much business as usual for us, isn't it? We've got our monthly episodes of Cycling Podcast Femina, Service Course, and Explore. And if you haven't listened to the most recent Service Course, I urge you to do so. It's absolutely fascinating. I learned an awful lot. And that's presented by Tom Wally and Lizzie Banks, the Bigla Katusha rider. And, well, we've got our Grand Tour coverage to look forward to as well. As usual, daily coverage from Giro, the Tour, and the Vuelta, and lots more besides. Before we go this week, chaps, can we say a few thank yous to some of you who've signed up as friends of the podcast. Very, very grateful indeed to you. So a big thanks from me to Thomas Bridges, Tony Moffa, Michael Payne, John Seoberg, hope I've said that correctly, David Wokes, William Valkeoja, again, I hope I've said that correctly, Andrew Scott, Adam Glover, Paul Whitelock, and Jeff Money.
And a big thank you to Mike Fagan, Chris Cole, Gerald Libassin, Peter Dash, Phil Healy, John Klein, James Sales, Arno Polman, Elizabeth Miller, and Beth Hazlitt.
And from me to David Warboys, Keith Jackson, Ben Chat, Mike Thornborough, Mark McBride, Joseph Galitzin, Peter Joyce, Julie Gill, Tessa Colster, and Matt Lane.
Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.